The following program is rated PG. Please be advised that what you are about to hear may contain mature themes, such as sexually suggestive situations, mild uses of bad language, and some instances of violence. Parental guidance is suggested.
This is a presentation from Dream Realm Enterprises, where dreams are our reality.
Dream Realm Enterprises, in association with the 4077th and All Better Audio, presents William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe. Let me call myself for the present William Wilson. The fair page now lying before me need not be sullied with my real appellation. This has already been too much of an object for the scorn, for the horror, for the detestation of my race. To the utmost regions of the globe have not the indignant winds bruited its unparalleled infamy. Oh, outcast of all outcasts, most abandoned, to the earth art thou not forever dead? To its honors, to its flowers, to its golden aspirations, and a cloud, dense, dismal, and limitless, does it not hang eternally between thy hopes and heaven? I would not, if I could, here or today, embody a record of my later years of unspeakable misery and unpardonable crime. This epoch, these later years, took unto themselves a sudden elevation in turpitude, whose origin alone it is my present purpose to assign. Men usually grow base by degrees. From me, in an instant, all virtue dropped bodily as a mantle. From comparatively trivial wickedness, I passed with the stride of a giant into more than the enormities of an Elah Garbulus. What chance, what one event brought this evil thing to pass? Bear with me while I relate. Death approaches, and the shadow which foreruns him has thrown a softening influence over my spirit. I long, in passing through the dim valley, for the sympathy, I had nearly said, for the pity of my fellow men. I would fain have them believe that I have been, in some measure, the slave of circumstances beyond human control. I would wish them to seek out for me, in the details I am about to give, some little oasis of fatality amid a wilderness of error. I would have them allow what they cannot refrain from allowing, that although temptation may have erewhile existed as great, man was never thus, at least tempted before, certainly never thus fell. And is it therefore that he has never thus suffered? Have I not indeed been living in a dream? And am I not now dying a victim to the horror and the mystery of the wildest of all sublunary visions? I am the descendant of a race whose imaginative and easily excitable temperament has at all times rendered them remarkable, and in my earliest infancy I gave evidence of having fully inherited the family character. As I advanced in age, it was more strongly developed, becoming, for many reasons, a cause of serious disquietude to my friends and of positive injury to myself. I grew self-willed, addicted to the wildest caprices, and a prey to the most ungovernable passions. Weak-minded and beset with constitutional infirmities akin to my own, my parents could do but little to check the evil propensities which distinguished me. Some feeble and ill-directed efforts resulted in complete failure on their part, and, of course, in total triumph on mine. Henceforward, my voice was a household law, and at an age when few children had abandoned their leading strings, I was left to the guidance of my own will and became, in all but name, the master of my own actions. My earliest recollections of a school life are connected with a large, rambling Elizabethan house in a misty-looking village of England, where were a vast number of gigantic and gnarled trees, and where all the houses were excessively ancient. In truth, it was a dreamlike and spirit-soothing place, that venerable old town. At this moment in fancy, I feel the refreshing chillness of its deeply shadowed avenues, inhale the fragrance of its thousand shrubberies, and thrill anew with undefinable delight at the deep hollow note of the church bell breaking each hour with sullen and sudden roar upon the stillness of the dusky atmosphere in which the fretted Gothic steeple lay embedded and asleep. It gives me perhaps as much pleasure as I can now in any manner experience to dwell upon minute recollections of the school and its concerns, steeped in misery as I am. Misery, alas, only too real. I shall be pardoned for seeking relief, however slight and temporary, in the weakness of a few rambling details. These, moreover, utterly trivial and even ridiculous in themselves, assume to my fancy adventitious importance as connected with a period and a locality when and where I recognize the first ambiguous monitions of the destiny which afterwards so fully overshadowed me. Let me then remember. The house, I have said, was old and irregular. The grounds were extensive, and a high and solid brick wall topped with a bed of mortar and broken glass encompassed the whole. This prison-like rampart formed the limit of our domain. Beyond it we saw but thrice a week. Once, every Saturday afternoon, when attended by two ushers, we were permitted to take brief walks in a body through some of the neighboring fields, and twice during Sunday, when we were paraded in the same formal manner to the morning and evening services at the one church of the village. Of this church, the principal of our school was pastor. With how deep a spirit of wonder and perplexity was I wont to regard him from our remote pew in the gallery, as with step solemn and slow he ascended the pulpit. This reverend man, with countenance so demurely benign, with robes so glossy and so clerically flowing, with a wig so minutely powdered, so rigid and so vast, could this be he who, of late, with sour visage and in snuffy habiliments, administered, ferule in hand, the draconian laws of this academy? Oh, gigantic paradox, too utterly monstrous for solution! At an angle of the ponderous wall frowned a more ponderous gate. It was riveted and studded with iron bolts and surmounted with jagged iron spikes. What impressions of deep awe did it inspire? It was never opened, save for the three periodical egressions and ingressions already mentioned. Then, in every creak of its mighty hinges, we found a plentitude of mystery, a world of matter for solemn remark and for more solemn meditation. The extensive enclosure was irregular in form, having more capacious recesses. Of these, three or four of the largest constituted the playground. It was level and covered with fine, hard gravel. I well remember it had no trees, no benches, nor anything similar within it. Of course, it was at the rear of the house. In front lay a small parterre, planted with box and other shrubs. But through this sacred division we passed only upon rare occasions indeed, such as a first advent to school, or final departure hence, or perhaps when a parent or friend having called for us, we joyfully took our way home for the Christmas or midsummer holidays. But the house, how quaint an old building was this. To me, how veritably a palace of enchantment. There was really no end to its windings, to its incomprehensible subdivisions. It was difficult, at any given time, to say with certainty upon which of its two stories one happened to be. From each room to each other, there were sure to be found three or four steps either in ascent or descent. Then the lateral branches were innumerable, inconceivable, and so returning in upon themselves that most exact ideas in regard to the whole mansion were not very far different from those with which we pondered upon infinity. During the 5 years of my residence here, I was never able to ascertain with precision in what remote locality lay the little sleeping apartment assigned to myself and some 18 or 20 other scholars. The schoolroom was the largest in the house, I could not help thinking, in the world. It was very long, narrow, and dismally low, with pointed Gothic windows and a ceiling of oak. In a remote and terror-inspiring angle was a square enclosure of 8 or 10 feet, comprising the sanctum, during hours, of our principal, the Reverend Dr. Bransby. It was a solid structure with massy door, sooner than open, which, in the presence of the Dominic, we would have all willingly perished by the peine forte dieu. In other angles were two other similar boxes, far less reverenced indeed, but still greatly matters of awe. One of these was the pulpit of the classical usher, one of the English and mathematical. Interspersed about the room, crossing and recrossing in endless irregularity, were innumerable benches and desks, black, ancient, and time-worn, piled desperately with much bethumbed books, and so beseamed with initial letters, names at full length, grotesque figures, and other multiplied efforts of the knife, as to have entirely lost what little of original form might have been there, proportioned in days long departed. A huge bucket with water stood at one extremity of the room, and a clock of stupendous dimensions at the other. Encompassed by the massy walls of this venerable academy, I passed, yet not in tedium or disgust, the years of the third lustrum of my life. The teeming brain of childhood requires no external world of incident to occupy or amuse it, and the apparently dismal monotony of school was replete with more intense excitement than my riper youth has derived from luxury or my full manhood from crime. Yet I must believe that my first mental development had in it much of the uncommon, even much of the outré. Upon mankind at large, the events of very early existence rarely leave in mature age any definite impression. All is grey shadow, a weak and irregular remembrance, an indistinct regathering of feeble pleasures and phantasmagoric pains. With me, this is not so. In childhood, I must have felt with the energy of a man what I now find stamped upon memory in lines as vivid, as deep, and as durable as the exergues of the Carthaginian medals. Yet in fact, in the fact of the world's view, how little was there to remember? The morning's awakening, the nightly summons to bed, the conings, the recitations, the periodical half-holidays, the preambulations, the playground with its broils, its pastimes, its intrigues. These, by a mental sorcery long forgotten, were made to involve a wilderness of sensation, a world of rich incident, and a universe of varied emotion, of excitement, of the most passionate and spirit-stirring. Oh, le bon temps, qu'est-ce que c'est que le défaut? In truth, the ardor, the enthusiasm, the imperiousness of my disposition soon rendered me a marked character among my schoolmates, and by slow but natural gradations gave me an ascendancy over all not greatly older than myself, over all with a single exception. This exception was found in the person of a scholar who, although no relation, bore the same Christian and surname as myself. A circumstance, in fact, little remarkable, for notwithstanding a noble descent, mine was one of those everyday appellations which seem, by prescriptive right, to have been time out of mind the common property of the mob. In this narrative, I have therefore designated myself as William Wilson, a fictitious title not very dissimilar to the real. My namesake alone, to those who in school phraseology constituted our set, presumed to compete with me in the studies of the class, in the sports and broils of the playground, to refuse implicit belief in my assertions and submission to my will, indeed to interfere with my arbitrary dictation in any respect whatsoever. If there is on earth a supreme and unqualified despotism, it is the despotism of a mastermind in boyhood over the less energetic spirits of its companions. Wilson's rebellion was to me a source of the greatest embarrassment, the more so as, in spite of the bravado with which in public I had made a point of treating him and his pretensions, I secretly felt that I feared him, and could not help thinking the equality which he maintained so easily with myself a proof of his true superiority, since not to be overcome cost me a perpetual struggle. Yet this superiority, even this equality, was in truth acknowledged by no one but myself. Our associates, by some unaccountable blindness, seemed not to even suspect it. Indeed, his competition, his resistance, and especially his impertinence and dogged interference with my purposes were not more pointed than private. He appeared to be destitute alike of the ambition which urged and of the passionate energy of mind which enabled me to excel. In his rivalry, he might have been supposed actuated solely by a whimsical desire to thwart, astonish, or mortify myself, although there were times when I could not help observing, with a feeling made up of wonder, abasement, and pique, that he mingled with his injuries, his insults, and his contradictions a certain most inappropriate and assuredly most unwelcome affectionateness of manner. I could only conceive this singular behavior to arise from a consummate self-conceit assuming the vulgar airs of patronage and protection. Perhaps it was this later trait in Wilson's conduct, conjoined with our identity of name and the mere accident of our having entered the school upon the same day, which set afloat the notion that we were brothers among the senior classes in the academy. These do not usually inquire with much strictness into the affairs of their juniors. I have before said, or should have said, that Wilson was not, in the most remote degree, connected with my family. But assuredly, if we had been brothers, we must have been twins. For after leaving Dr. Bransby's, I casually learned that my namesake was born on the 19th of January, 1813. And this is a somewhat remarkable coincidence, for the day is precisely that of my own nativity. It may seem strange that in spite of the continual anxiety occasioned me by the rivalry of Wilson and his intolerable spirit of contradiction, I could not bring myself to hate him altogether. We had, to be sure, nearly every day a quarrel in which, yielding me publicly the palm of victory, he, in some manner, contrived to make me feel that it was he who had deserved it. Yet a sense of pride on my part and a veritable dignity on his own kept us always upon what are called speaking terms, while there are many points of strong congeniality in our tempers, operating to awake me in a sentiment which our position alone perhaps prevented from ripening into friendship. It is difficult indeed to define or even to describe my real feelings towards him. They formed a motley and heterogeneous admixture, some petulant animosity, which was not yet hatred, some esteem, more respect, much fear, with a world of uneasy curiosity. To the moralist, it would be unnecessary to say in addition that Wilson and myself were the most inseparable of companions. It was no doubt the anomalous state of affairs existing between us which turned all my attacks upon him, and they were many, either open or covert, into the channel of banter or practical joke, giving pain while assuming the aspect of mere fun, rather than into a more serious and determined hostility. But my endeavors on this head were by no means uniformly successful, even when my plans were the most wittily concocted, for my namesake had much about him, in character, of that unassuming and quiet austerity which, while enjoying the poignancy of its own jokes, has no heel of Achilles in itself, and absolutely refuses to be laughed at. I could find indeed but one vulnerable point, and that lying in a personal peculiarity arising perhaps from constitutional disease would have been spared by any antagonist less than his wit's end than myself. My rival had a weakness in the vocal or guttural organs, which precluded him from raising his voice at any time above a very low whisper. Of this defect I did not fall to take what poor advantage lay in my power. Wilson's retaliations in kind were many, and there was one form of his practical wit that disturbed me beyond measure. How his sagacity first discovered at all that so petty a thing would vex me is a question I never could solve, but having discovered, he habitually practiced the annoyance. I had always felt aversion to my uncourtly patronymic and its very common, if not plebeian, praenomen. The words were venom in my ears, and when, upon the day of my arrival, a second William Wilson came also to the academy, I felt angry with him for bearing the name, and doubly disgusted with the name because a stranger bore it. Who would be the cause of its twofold repetition? Who would be constantly in my presence, and whose concerns in the ordinary routine of the school business, but inevitably on account of the detestable coincidence, be often confounded with my own. The feeling of vexation thus engendered grew stronger with every circumstance, tending to show resemblance, moral or physical, between my rival and myself. I had not then discovered the remarkable fact that we were of the same age, but I saw that we were of the same height, and I perceived that we were even singularly alike in general contour of person and outline of feature. I was galled, too, by the rumor touching a relationship which had grown current in the upper forms. In a word, nothing could more seriously disturb me, although I scrupulously concealed such disturbance than any allusion to a similarity of mind, person, or condition existing between us. But in truth, I had no reason to believe that, with the exception of the matter of relationship and in the case of Wilson himself, this similarity had ever been made a subject of comment, or even observed at all by our schoolfellows. That he observed it in all its bearings, and as fixedly as I, was apparent, but that he could discover in such circumstances so fruitful a field of annoyance can only be attributed, as I said before, to his more than ordinary penetration. His cue, which was to perfect an imitation of myself, lay both in words and in actions, and most admiredly did he play his part. My dress, it was an easy matter to copy. My gait and general manner were, without difficulty, appropriated. In spite of his constitutional defect, even my voice did not escape him. My louder tones were, of course, unattempted, but then the key, it was identical. And his singular whisper, it grew the very echo of my own. How greatly this most exquisite portraiture harassed me, for it could not justly be termed a caricature. I will not now venture to describe. I had but one consolation in the fact that the imitation, apparently, was noticed by myself alone, and that I had to endure only the knowing and strangely sarcastic smiles of my namesake himself. Satisfied with having produced in my own bosom the intended effect, he seemed to chuckle in secret over the sting he had inflicted, and was characteristically disregardful of the public applause which the success of his witty endeavors might have so easily elicited. That the school, indeed, did not feel his design, perceive its accomplishment, and participate in his sneer was, for many anxious months, a riddle I could not resolve. Perhaps the graduation of his copy rendered it so readily perceptible, or more possibly, I owe my security to the master air of the copyist, who disdained the letter, which in a painting is all the obtuse can see, gave but the full spirit of his original for my individual contemplation and chagrin. I have already more than once spoken of the disgusting air of patronage which he assumed toward me, and of his frequent officious interference with my will. This interference often took the ungracious character of advice, advice not openly given, but hinted or insinuated. I received it with a repugnance which gained strength as I grew in years. Yet in this distant day, let me do him the simple justice to acknowledge that I can recall no occasion when the suggestions of my rival were on the side of those errors or follies so usual to his immature age and seeming inexperience, that his moral sense, at least, if not his general talents and worldly wisdom, was far keener than my own, and that I might today have been a better and thus a happier man, had I less frequently rejected the counsels embodied in those meaning whispers, which I then too cordially hated and too bitterly despised. As it was, I at length grew restive in the extreme under his distasteful supervision, and daily resented more and more openly what I considered his intolerable arrogance. I have said that in the first years of our connection as schoolmates, my feelings in regard to him might have been easily ripened into friendship, but in the later months of my residence at the academy, although the intrusion of his ordinary manner had beyond doubt in some measure abated my sentiments in nearly similar proportion, partook very much of positive hatred. Upon one occasion, he saw this, I think, and afterwards avoided or made a show of avoiding me. It was about this same period, if I remember aright, that in an altercation of violence with him, in which he was more than usually thrown off his guard and spoke and acted in an openness of demeanor rather foreign to his nature, I discovered, or fancied I discovered, in his accent, his air, and general appearance, a something which first startled, then deeply interested me by bringing to mind dim visions of my earliest infancy, wild, confused, and thronging memories of a time when memory herself was yet unborn. I cannot better describe the sensation which oppressed me than by saying that I could with difficulty shake off the belief of my having been acquainted with the being who stood before me at some epoch very long ago, some point in the past, even indefinitely remote. The delusion, however, faded rapidly as it came, and I mention it all but to define the day of the last conversation I held with my singular namesake. The huge old house and its countless subdivisions had several large chambers communicating with each other, where slept the great number of the students. There were, however, as much necessarily happens in a building so awkwardly planned, many little nooks or recesses, the odds and ends of a structure, and these the economic ingenuity of Dr. Bransby had also fitted up as dormitories. Although, being the merest closets, they were capable of accommodating but a single individual. One of these apartments was occupied by Wilson. One night, about the close of my fifth year at school, and immediately after the altercation just mentioned, finding everyone wrapped in sleep, I arose from bed, and lamp in hand, stole through the wilderness of narrow passages from my own bedroom to that of my rival. I had long been plotting one of those ill-natured pieces of practical wit at his expense, in which I had hitherto been so uniformly unsuccessful. It was my intention now to put my scheme in operation, and I resolved to make him feel the whole extent of the malice of which I was imbued. Having reached his closet, I noiselessly entered, leaving the lamp with the shade over it on the outside. I advanced a step and listened to the sound of his tranquil breathing. Assured of his being asleep, I returned, took the light, and with it again approached the bed. Closed curtains were around it, which, in my prosecution of my plan, I slowly and quietly withdrew, when the bright rays fell vividly upon the sleeper, and in my eyes, at the same moment, upon his countenance. I looked, and a numbness of iciness of feeling instantly pervaded my frame. My breast heaved. My knees tottered. My whole spirit became possessed with an objectionless yet intolerable horror. Gasping for breath, I lowered the lamp in still nearer proximity to the face. Were these the lineaments of William Wilson? I saw, indeed, that they were his, but I shook as if with a fit of the ague in fancying they were not. What was there about them to confound me in this manner? I gazed, while my brain reeled with the multitude of incoherent thoughts. Not thus he appeared, assuredly not thus. In the vivacity of his waking hours, the same name, the same contour of person, the same day of arrival at the academy, and then his dogged and meaningless imitation of my gait, my voice, my habits, and my manner. Was it, in truth, within the bounds of human possibility, that what I now saw was the result merely of the habitual practice of his sarcastic imitation? Awe-stricken and with creeping shudder, I extinguished the lamp, passed silently from the chamber, and left at once the halls of that old academy, never to enter them again. After a lapse of several months spent at home in mere idleness, I find myself a student at Eton. The brief interval had been sufficient to enfeeble my remembrance of the events at Dr. Bransby's, or at least to effect a material change of the nature of the feelings of which I remembered them. The truth, the tragedy of the drama was no more. I could now find room to doubt the evidence of my senses, and seldom called up the subject at all, but with wonder at the extent of human credulity, and a smile of the vivid force of the imagination which I hereditarily possessed. Neither was this species of skepticism likely to be distinguished by the character of the life I led at Eton. the vortex of thoughtless folly into which I so immediately and so recklessly plunged washed away all but the froth of my past hours, engulfed at once every solid or serious impression, and left to memory only the various levities of a former existence. I do not wish, however, to trace the course of my miserable profligacy here, a profligacy which set at defiance the laws while it eluded the vigilance of the institution. 3 years of folly passed without profit had but given me rooted habits of vice and added in a somewhat unusual degree to my bodily stature. When, after a week of soulless dissipation, I invited a small party of the most dissolute students to a secret carousal in my chambers, we met at a late hour of the night, for our debaucheries were to be faithfully protracted until morning. The wine flowed freely, and there were not wanting other and perhaps more dangerous seductions, so that the gray dawn had already faintly appeared in the east, while our delirious extravagance was at its height. Madly flushed with cards and intoxication, I was in the act of insisting upon a toast of more than wonted profanity, when my attention was suddenly diverted by the violent, although partial, unclosing of the door of the apartment, and by the eager voice of a servant from without. He said that some person, apparently in great haste, demanded to speak with me in the hall. Wildly excited with wine, the unexpected interruption rather delighted than surprised me. I staggered forward at once, and a few steps brought me to the vestibule of the building. In this low and small room there hung no lamp, and now no light at all was admitted save that of the exceedingly feeble dawn that made its way through the semicircular window. As I put my foot over the threshold, I became aware of the figure of a youth about my own height, inhabited in a white kerseymere morning frock, cut in the novel fashion of the one myself wore at the moment. This the faint light enabled me to perceive, but the features of his face I could not distinguish. Upon my entering, he strode hurriedly up to me and seized me by the arm with a gesture of petulant impatience, whispering the words, "William Wilson," he said in my ear. I grew perfectly sober in an instant. There was that in the manner of the stranger, and in the tremulous shake of his uplifted finger as he held it between my eyes, and the light which filled me with unqualified amazement. But it was not this which had so violently moved me. It was the pregnancy of solemn admonition in the singular, low, hissing utterance. And above all, it was the character, the tone, the key of those few simple and familiar yet whispered syllables which came with a thousand thronging memories of bygone days and struck upon my soul with the shock of a galvanic battery. Ere I could recover the use of my senses, he was gone. Although this event failed not of a vivid effect upon my disordered imagination, yet was it evanescent as vivid. For some weeks, indeed, I busied myself in earnest inquiry, or was wrapped in a cloud of morbid speculation. I did not pretend to disguise from my perception the identity of the singular individual who thus perseveringly interfered with my affairs and harassed me with his insinuated counsel. But who and what was this Wilson? And whence came he? And what were his purposes? Upon neither of these points could I be satisfied, merely ascertaining in regard to him that a sudden accident of his family had caused his removal from Dr. Brainsby's academy on the afternoon of the day in which I myself had eloped. But in a brief period, I ceased to think about the subject, my attention being all absorbed in this contemplated departure for Oxford. Thither I soon went, the uncalculated vanity of my parents furnishing me with an outfit and annual establishment which could enable me to indulge at will in the luxury already so dear to my heart, to vie in profuseness of expenditure with the haughtiest heirs of the wealthiest earldoms of Great Britain. Excited by such appliances to vice, my constitutional temperament broke forth with redoubled ardor, and I spurned even the common restraints of decency in the mad infatuation of my revels. But it were absurd to pause in the details of my extravagance. Let it suffice that among spendthrifts I out-heroded Herod, and that, giving name to a multitude of novel follies, I added no brief appendix to the long catalogue of vices then usual in the most dissolute university of Europe. It could hardly be credited, however, that I, even here, so utterly fallen from the gentlemanly estate, as to seek acquaintance with the vilest arts of the gambler by profession, and having become an adept in his despicable science, to practice it habitually as a means of increasing my already enormous income at the expense of the weak-minded among my fellow collegians. Such, nevertheless, was the fact. and the very enormity of this offense against all manly and honorable sentiment proved beyond doubt the main, if not the sole reason of the impunity in which it was committed. Who indeed among my most abandoned associates would not rather have disputed the clearest evidence of his senses than have suspected of such courses the gay, the frank, the generous William Wilson, the noblest and most commoner at Oxford? Him whose follies, said his parasites, were but the follies of youth and unbridled fancy, whose errors but inimitable whim, whose darkest vice but a careless and dashing extravagance. It had been now 2 years successfully busied in this way when there came to the university a young parvenu nobleman, Glendinning. Rich, said report, as Herodes Atticus, his riches too, as easily acquired. I soon found him of weak intellect, and of course marked him as a fitting subject for my skill. I frequently engaged him in play, and contrived, with the gambler's usual art, to let him win considerable sums, the more effectually to entangle him in my snares. At length, my schemes being ripe, I met with him, with the full intention of this meeting being the final and decisive, at the chambers of a fellow commoner, Mr. Preston, equally intimate with both, but who, to do him justice, entertained not even the remote suspicion of my design. To give this a better coloring, I had contrived to have assembled a party of some 8 or 10, and was solicitously careful that the introduction of the cards should appear accidental and originate in the proposal of my contemplated dupe himself. To be brief upon a vile topic, none of the low finesse was omitted, so customary upon similar occasions that it was a just matter for wonder how any are still found so besotted to fall its victim. We had protracted our sitting far into the night, and I had at length effected the maneuver of getting Glendinning as my sole antagonist. The game, too, was my favorite, écarté. The rest of the company, interested in the extent of our play, had abandoned their own cards and were sitting around us as spectators. The parvenu, who had been induced by my artifices in the early part of the evening to drink deeply, now shuffled, dealt, or played with a wild nervousness of a manner of which his intoxication, I thought, might partially, but could not altogether account. In a very short period, he had become my debtor to a large amount, when, having taken a long draught of port, he did precisely what I had been coolly anticipating. He proposed to double our already extravagant stakes. With a well-feigned show of reluctance, and not until my repeated refusal had seduced him into some angry words which gave a color of pique to my compliance, did I finally comply. The result, of course, did but prove how entirely the prey was in my toils. In less than an hour, he had quadrupled his debt. For some time, his countenance had been losing the florid tinge lent to it by the wine, but now, to my astonishment, I perceived that it had grown to a pallor truly fearful. I say to my astonishment, Glendinning had been represented to my eager inquiries as immeasurably wealthy, and the sums which he had yet lost, although in themselves vast, could not, I supposed, very seriously annoy, much less so violently affect him. That he was overcome by the wine just swallowed was the idea which most readily presented itself, and rather with a view to the preservation of my own character in the eyes of my associates, then from a less interested motive. I was about to insist peremptorily upon a discontinuance of the game, when some expressions at my elbow from among the company, and an ejaculation evincing utter despair on the part of Glendinning, gave me to understand that I had effected his total ruin under circumstances which, rendering him an object of the pity of all, should have protected him from the ill offices even of a fiend. What now might have been my conduct is difficult to say. The pitiable condition of my dupe had thrown an air of embarrassed gloom over all, and for some moments a profound silence was maintained, during which I could not help feeling my cheeks tingle with the many burning glances of scorn and reproach cast upon me by the less abandoned of the party. I will even own that an intolerable weight of anxiety was for a brief instant lifted from my bosom by the sudden and extraordinary interruption which ensued. The wide, heavy folding doors of the apartment were all at once thrown open to their full extent, with a vigorous and rushing impetuosity that extinguished as if by magic every candle in the room. Their light, in dying, enabled us just to perceive that a stranger had entered, about my own height and closely muffled in a cloak. The darkness, however, was now total, and we could only feel that he was standing in our midst. Before any one of us could recover from the extreme astonishment into which this rudeness has thrown all, we heard the voice of the intruder.
"Gentlemen,"
he said, in a low, distinct, and never-to-be-forgotten whisper which thrilled to the very marrow of my bones.
"Gentlemen, I make no apology for this behavior, because in thus behaving, I am but fulfilling a duty. You are, beyond doubt, uninformed of the true character of the person who has tonight won at Ecarte a large sum of money from Lord Glendinning. I will therefore put you upon an expeditious and decisive plan of obtaining this very necessary information. Please to examine at your leisure the inner linings of the cuff of his left sleeve and the several little packages which may be found in the somewhat capacious pockets of his embroidered morning wrapper."
While he spoke, so profound was the stillness that one might have heard a pin drop upon the floor. In ceasing, he departed at once and as abruptly as he had entered. Shall I describe my sensations? Must I say that I felt all the horrors of the damned? Most assuredly, I had little time given for reflection. Many hands roughly seized me upon the spot, and lights were immediately re-procured. A search ensued. In the lining of my sleeve were found all of the court cards essential in écarté, and in the pockets of my wrapper a number of packs, facsimiles of those used at our sittings, with the single exception that mine were of the species called technically rondes, the honors being slightly convex at the ends, and the lower cards slightly convex at the sides. In this disposition, the dupe who cuts, as customary, at the length of the pack will invariably find that he cuts his antagonist an honor, while the gambler, cutting at the breadth, will as certainly cut nothing for his victim, which may count in the records of the game. A burst of indignation upon this discovery would have affected me less than the silent contempt or the sarcastic composure with which it was received.
"Mr. Wilson,"
said our host, stooping to remove from beneath his feet an exceedingly luxurious cloak of rare furs.
"Mr. Wilson, this is your property."
The weather was cold, and upon quitting my own room, I'd thrown a cloak over my dressing wrapper, putting it off upon reaching the scene of play.
"I presume it is supererogatory to seek here,"
he said, eyeing the folds of the garment with a bitter smile,
"for any further evidence of your skill. Indeed, we have had enough. You will see the necessity, I hope, of quitting Oxford. At all events, of quitting instantly my chambers."
Abased, humbled to the dust as I then was, it was probable that I should have resented this galling language by immediate personal violence had not my whole attention been at the moment arrested by the fact of the most startling character. The cloak which I had worn was of a rare description of fur. How rare? How extravagantly costly? I shall not venture to say. Its fashion, too, was of my own fantastic invention, for I was fastidious in an absurd degree of coxcombry in matters of this frivolous nature. When, therefore, Mr. Preston reached me that which he had picked up upon the floor and near the folding doors of the apartment, it was with an astonishment nearly bordering upon terror that I perceived my own already hanging on my arm, where I had no doubt unwittingly placed it, and the one presented to me was but its exact counterpart in even the minutest possible particular. The singular being who had so disastrously exposed me had been muffled, I remembered, in a cloak, and none had been worn by any of the other members of the party, with the exception of myself. Retaining some presence of mind, I took the one offered to me by Preston, placed it unnoticed over my own, left the apartment with a resolute scowl of defiance, and next morning, ere dawn of day, commenced a harried journey from Oxford to the continent in a perfect agony of horror and of shame. I fled in vain The evil destiny pursued me as if in exaltation, and proved indeed that the exercise of its mysterious dominion had as yet only begun. Scarcely had I set foot in Paris as I had fresh evidence of the detestable interest taken by this Wilson in my concerns. Years flew while I experienced no relief. Villain! At Rome, with how untimely yet how spectral an officiousness stepped he in between me and my ambition. At Vienna too, at Berlin, and at Moscow, where in truth had I not but a cause to curse him within my heart, from his inscrutable tyranny did I at length flee, panic-stricken as from a pestilence, and to the very ends of the earth I fled in vain. And again, in secret communion with my own spirit, would I demand the questions. Who is he? Whence he came? And what are his objects? But no answer was there found. And then I scrutinized with a minute scrutiny the forms and the methods and the leading traits of his impertinent supervision. But even here there was very little upon which to base a conjecture. It was noticeable indeed that in no one of the multiplied instances in which he had of late crossed my path had he so crossed it except to frustrate those schemes or to disturb those actions which, if fully carried out, might have resulted in bitter mischief. Poor justification this, in truth, for an authority so imperiously assumed. Poor indemnity for natural rights of self-agency so pertinaciously, so insultingly denied. I had also been forced to notice that my tormentor, for a very long period of time, while scrupulously and with miraculous dexterity maintaining his whim of an identity of apparel with myself, had so contrived it in the execution of his varied interference with my will that I saw not at any moment the features of his face. Be Wilson what he might, this at least was but the veriest of affectation or of folly. Could he, for an instance, have supposed that in my admonisher at Eton, in the destroyer of my honor at Oxford, in him who thwarted my ambition at Rome, my revenge at Paris, my passionate love at Naples, or what he falsely termed my avarice in Egypt, that in this my arch enemy and evil genius could fall to recognize the William Wilson of my schoolboy days, the namesake, the companion, the rival, the hated and dreaded rival at Dr. Bransby's? Impossible! But let me hasten to the last eventful scene of this drama. Thus far, I had succumbed supinely to this imperious domination. The sentiment of deep awe with which I habitually regarded the elevated character, the majestic wisdom, the apparent omnipresence and omnipotence of Wilson, added to a feeling of even terror with which certain other traits of his nature and assumptions inspired me, had operated hitherto to impress me with an idea of my own utter weakness and helplessness, and to suggest an implicit, although bitterly reluctant, submission to his arbitrary will. But of late days I had given myself up entirely to wine and its maddening influences upon my hereditary temper, rendering me more and more impatient of control. I began to murmur, to hesitate, to resist. And was it only fancy which induced me to believe that, with the increase of my own firmness, that my own tormentor underwent a proportional diminution? Be this as it may, I now began to feel the inspiration of a burning hope, and at length nurtured in my secret thoughts a stern and desperate resolution that I would submit no longer to be enslaved. It was at Rome, during the carnival of 1800-something, that I attended a masquerade at the Palazzo at the Neapolitan Duke de Broglio. I had indulged more freely than usual at the excesses of the wine table, and now the suffocating atmosphere of the crowded rooms irritated me beyond endurance. The difficulty, too, of forcing my way through the mazes of the company contributed not a little to the ruffling of my temper, for I was anxiously seeking, let me not say with that unworthy motive, the young, the gay, the beautiful wife of the aged and doting de Broglio. With a too unscrupulous confidence, she had previously communicated with me the secret of the costume in which she would be habited. And now, having caught a glimpse of her person, I was hurrying to make my way into her presence. At this moment, I felt a light hand placed upon my shoulder, and that ever-remembered low damnable whisper within my ear. In an absolute frenzy of wrath, I turned at once upon him who had thus interrupted me and seized him violently by tail collar. He was attired, as I expected, in a costume altogether similar to my own, wearing a Spanish cloak of blue velvet, begirt about the waist with a crimson belt sustaining a rapier. A mask of black silk entirely covered his face. "Scoundrel!" I said in a voice husky with rage, while every syllable I uttered seemed as new fuel to my fury. "Scoundrel, impostor, accursed villain, you shall not dog me unto death. Follow me, or I shall stab you where you stand." And I broke my way from the ballroom into a small antechamber adjoining, dragging him unresistingly with me as I went. Upon entering, I thrust him furiously from me. He staggered against the wall while I closed the door with an oath and commanded him to draw. He hesitated but for an instant, then, with a slight sigh, drew in silence and put himself upon his defense. The contest was brief indeed. I was frantic with every species of wild excitement and felt within my single arm the energy and power of a multitude. In a few seconds, I forced him by sheer strength against the wainscoting, and thus, getting him at mercy, plunged my sword with brute ferocity repeatedly through and through his bosom. At that instant, some person tried the latch of the door. I hastened to prevent an intrusion, and then immediately returned to my dying antagonist. But what human language can adequately portray the astonishment, that horror which possessed me at the spectacle then presented to my view? The brief moment at which I averted my eyes had been sufficient to produce, apparently, a material change in the arrangements at the upper or farther end of the room. A large mirror, so at first it seemed to me in my confusion, now stood where none had been perceptible before. And as I stepped up into its extremity of terror, my own image, but with features all pale and dabbled in blood, advanced to me with a feeble and tottering gait. Thus it appeared, I say, but was not. It was my antagonist. It was Wilson, who then stood before me in the agonies of his dissolution. His mask and cloak lay where he had thrown them upon the floor. Not a thread in all his raiment, not a line in all the marked and singular lineaments of his face, which was not even in my most absolute identity, mine own. It was Wilson. But he spoke no longer in a whisper, and I could have fancied that I myself was speaking while he said,
"You have conquered, and I yield. Yet henceforward art thou also dead. Dead to the world, to heaven, and to hope. In me didst thou exist, and in my death, see by this image, which is thine own, how utterly thou hast murdered thyself."
You have been listening to Showcase, William Wilson, which was written by Edgar Allan Poe, adapted to audio by Victor Aurelius, and which starred Victor Aurelius as William Wilson, Jeff Niles as Wilson, and Jeff Niles as the host. The incidental music was provided by Kevin MacLeod. The sound designer, executive producer, and director was Victor Aurelius of the 4077th and All Better Audio. The series, Dream Realm Showcase, was created by Jonathan Patrick Russell, and the copyright is held by Dream Realm Enterprises. Any rebroadcast or reproduction of this program without the express written permission of Dream Realm Enterprises is strictly prohibited. Thank you for listening. We invite you to visit us on the web at dreamrealmsite.com. And if you'd like to email us with your comments or questions, you may do so at darkbuilding1@yahoo.com. The copyright of this program is held by Dream Realm Enterprises, the 4077th, and all Better Audio 2013. All rights reserved. And finally, this has been your host, Victor Aurelius, for Dream Realm Showcase. Join us next time for another incredible story.